This month on the Pop Culture Radio Show, we've got Nix Nugent, who is a singer, songwriter, activist, educator of young minds. She is here to chat about, there's quite a wide-ranging interview actually, and rather than just focusing on one thing, we've done more of an interview, so finding out about, trying to find out what makes her tick, about things that inspire her. And also, one of those things is the work of Lars von Trier, in particular, Melancholia and Nymphomaniac. And we'll also find time to squeeze in one of her tracks for your listening pleasure as well. So without further ado, let's get straight to the interview. So Nix Nugent, welcome to the Pop Culture Radio Show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm quite excited to be here and being omnipresent.
Omnipresent.
With this omni...
That's a reference to, just for people at home, that would make sense. The microphone I use for this, I had to look up the right setting that I was using. So setting 3 on the blue snowball microphone, which activates something called an omni-capsule.
It means you're going to the future.
It sounds like something that the heroes in a bad science fiction film need to find to fix their spaceship to save the universe.
And but, it really looks like... capsule.
It is a very science fiction-y looking device.
It is. It's on a tripod as well.
Mm.
Should we fail to mention that? And yeah, it looks very futuristic.
For those people at home who haven't heard of you, you're a singer, yes?
Yep. Singer-songer. Oh, you're gonna have to re-edit that. Singer-songwriter. But I'm also a teacher and an activist, so kind of jack of all trades, master of none, really.
Just a little bit about yourself before we get into what we're talking about, but what are what are the earliest pieces of pop culture that you can remember? When you were a kid?
That's a good one. I remember when I was really young, I don't particularly remember living in America, but we lived in West Palms, and I have got some recordings of on an old cassette. Oh. I think it was like a... I think it was a Scotch tape, actually. It was black, and it's got... My mum recorded me singing as a child, and it's got me in the background going, "Put 9 and 9 on, Mum." And that was 99 Red Balloons. Because I loved it so much. So I'd call it 9 and 9. "Put 9 and 9 on, Mum." And I'd be sort of singing along in the background. So, yeah, real sort of 80s. 80s is kind of my vibe. I've written a lot of songs with intertextuality within them where I literally mention the name of the song or I'll drop a line in of a song. For example, I've got a song where I mention "You Spin Me Right Round."
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got the cough. And I can't help it because I love it so much. I find a way to sort of weave it in within the fabric of what I do, and it's not enough to get sued. It's just a nod. It's a respectful nod to the artists or to, you know, the things that I love and respect.
It's funny that the pop music from when you were a kid really stays with you in quite a powerful way.
It does, and the sights and the smells, and it really brings back memories, quite strong memories, because I lost my dad when I was quite young, so when I think back to those times and I listen to that tape, I can actually hear his voice in the background, which is really special. And I think I'm actually, considering my age, I'm sort of from the generation where actually recording at home became that little bit easier.
It became a standard thing on cassette decks that have a little mic built in.
Exactly. I used to absolutely love it because I'd always record myself.
Yeah.
And then I found a way on my, I think I had it Hitachi or something. It was ridiculous. It was like a real sort of like plasticky sort of, it had like bright minty green buttons on it, and I'd record myself and then record over myself. So I found a way to actually record harmonies.
Oh, right.
Which was amazing.
Also, it was a multi-track recorder.
It had 2 tapes, beside it. I'm not very technical, so I don't know. I just said, is it? I don't know. I know what I like. I don't really know much about technical stuff. So yeah. If I do a gig, I'm like, can you do a bit of this and make it a little bit less shouty? I don't really know technical sort of.
When I was a kid, me and my cousin just lived down like 2 miles away. So obviously, our parents would use each other as babysitters and what have you.
Very convenient.
And he had, just a two tape deck with a mic in it, and we would like record little radio shows. The other one would have to go off and play with toys elsewhere for a while, and then we'd record links, and we would record songs and stuff into it, and
that's
then the other
really
person
good.
Had to come
links.
Back and well, oh hey,
genius
you're listening
links.
To you're listening to be radio.
Did you have
one.
A name? You had
no,
a name.
No,
we
didn't get that far. It's
embarrassing
DJ
that you
Nigel
don't share
something.
It.
I don't know. it wasn't that advanced. It's literally we just do like a couple of songs and then the other person'd have to sit and listen to it.
Mm.
But yeah, it's funny, like things like that became really common rather than being
out of reach.
Yeah. And so with it, like it is with recording video now, like everyone's got a phone with a camera in it. When I was a kid, video
be
recorders
like
were really expensive.
Blaster on your shoulder, wouldn't
yeah.
it? It'd be like this big.
And they're really expensive.
Mm.
I mean, my parents couldn't afford anything like that. I had this random uncle that.
And the tapes were expensive as well. It
yeah.
wasn't just the initial equipment, it was the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You'd have to do.
I had this random uncle that had one that I'd see kind of once a year, but I never got to go on it. And so that was it. Whereas now it's like so common to have all these video records of, family and friends and stuff.
It's kind of dangerous in a way. Dangerous but good. No, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
It's
good to have it so accessible because you can be creative in a really quick and easy way. It's good. But then again, with all these horrible slap happy.
Yeah.
It slap happy?
Happy slapping.
Yeah, that's the one. Oh my God, I sound like I'm about 50. Slap happy. Yeah.
God,
that was awful, yeah.
Yeah. So, there's always going to be dickheads, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So when did you start playing music, singing?
Well, I pretty much sang before I could talk, really. My mum always used to say that I was just very sort of melodic and just kind of, just sort of humming to myself. And on the tape, actually, it's quite funny. I'm quite precocious. I'm like, and I've got this weird sort of transatlantic accent because I go to Montessori out there. So my mum desperately tried to keep me sounding English. She'd be like, no, it's mummy, not mommy, because I had this weird... Because she didn't like the way that they said it. And they could never say my name right, because it was always Nicola. So it would be like, where'd you put the emphasis on the ni, the cola, or...
Yeah.
So, yeah, because they're all called Nicole, aren't they? So
that is, I wouldn't have thought that. There's not many American Nicolas.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'd make up these ridiculous songs. And you could tell, I could tell by listening back that they were made up, but I think I managed to fool my mum.
Yeah.
Maybe she was just really sweet and just kind of went along with it. But I was like, no. She's like, should we do this one? And I was like, no, I want to sing Christmas Tree. And she'd be like, how does that go? And it'd be like, Christmas Tree, Christmas Tree. Like this ridiculous American accent, and it just wouldn't really go anywhere. It just kind of fade out into nothingness.
And then you realised that...
But, yeah, I wasn't really that good at making up songs extempore. I wasn't made for Whose Line Is It Anyway at that age. I am now, but,
I was going to pour this. I just read it right next to the microphone, so it's probably going to...
Oh, it'd be interesting. It'd be like there's a flood happening.
Like
it could be like biblical or something.
Like at the beginning of...
The representational of...
What's that?
Oh,
it's that rap song with the sound of the bong lighting up at the beginning.
Is it Dr. Dre?
Yeah. And this is the podcast version. So obviously, if you're a rapper, have a smoke a blow. If you're a podcaster, you'll drink red wine.
It's slightly more middle class.
Yeah.
And what are we drinking?
Well, this is...
get your priorities right.
It is a Rioja.
Oh, very nice. Thank you for furnishing me with the...
Yeah, unfortunately, I do like wine, but generally speaking, my idea of what wine is nice wine and not nice wine.
Yeah.
And then I don't... That's nice wine. That's not nice wine. That I don't... Okay, yeah, sure.
Just
why not?
Go with it, yeah. It's a staple, that works for you.
Yeah. Well, I've got quite a high tolerance.
In vino veritas?
Yeah, in Wine the Truth.
Yes, so that's the...
It should be the motto of this podcast.
It should be. We were just saying that beforehand, weren't we? We were saying that you know, should one lubricate one's vocal cords before commencing on...
Yeah, well, I think a little bit of lubrication on podcasts is fine, but...
Yeah.
Jaded, you don't really want to know me, 'cause I've been places you won't go, and maybe you don't really want to hear this, 'cause I've been to places you've no idea about. Your love is lazy, you don't appreciate or praise me. Pink locks, but marigolds and daisies. In madness, you make me create. Oh no. Oh no. Well, maybe you think that you can tell me. Oh, I see the way you manipulate me. It's crazy the way you try to blame me. Oh, this can't be healthy to feel so much hate.
So Melancholia by Lars von Trier. A really interesting film. Kirsten Dunst, Charlotte Gainsborough, and Jack Bauer. In a film where it looks like the world is going to end, everyone's very worried. So did you see when it came out?
It's 2011, I think. I don't profess... I'm not an expert on anything, really, but... I just know what I like, and
yeah.
I'm quite a visual person, in some respects, not in a shallow way. However, I saw this cover, and something about it spoke to me, and I think it resonated with my
Kirsten
music.
Kirsten Dunst in a wedding dress,
yes,
with the flowers.
Exactly, yeah,
yeah.
Sorry, I didn't clarify that, but she's, yeah, in a white, pure wedding dress, she's holding the flowers, she looks like she's in a pond.
Yeah.
Or in water and about to drown herself.
Really kind of references that famous picture of Ophelia.
John Everett Millet, I think it is, and it's one of my favourite paintings. And I actually based a song that I wrote called Ophelia on it.
It's a very good song.
Which perhaps we might be able to show at some point.
Yes.
Thank you for saying that. That means a lot. That's nice. It's quite a poncy song. It's
nothing wrong with a bit of ponce.
Yeah, well, you know, I like you, love literature, and it references what it's about of Ophelia and Hamlet, as well as being slightly autobiographical. And I think that's why Melancholia spoke to me, because it actually reminded me of some artwork that I've been working on for Ophelia.
Yeah.
And just Kirsten Dunst is just gorgeous. She's a major hottie.
Well, and this was like a role for her, because she'd had a bit of a rut for a few years of being in either slightly shit films, or she had this great promise when she kind of came along. And then she just had this run of not very good films. And she's got kind of a reputation.
Is that romantic film in there somewhere?
Yeah.
The one where they go to like Mexico or something.
God.
Was that considered bad? I thought it was bad. I don't what it's called. I'm so bad with names.
Well, I'm just going to...
I'm good with my children's names at school.
Yes.
But,
yeah, she...
I'm a teacher, by the way. I didn't tell you my profession, did I? Am I allowed to do that?
I mean, to be honest, it's Elizabeth Town. That's rubbish. And Wimbledon, which is... was Elizabeth Town and Wimbledon, like, within kind of 2 years of each other... Both kind of rom-coms.
Mm.
I mean, Elizabeth Town was Cameron Crowe, and it's I really didn't like it. Wimbledon is perfectly charming, but it's not great. But it's just, I think there's the trap for young women actors in Hollywood to fall into the rom-com trap.
Yeah.
And Scarlett Johansson's just dragged herself out of it impressively.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen like Under the Skin.
I loved that.
Oh yeah.
It was brilliant.
Astonishing. She's so good in it, and it's so kind of unforgettable. And
brave.
Yeah.
And honest and dark and quite innovative, I think, in a way.
It is one of those, how the hell did they do that things with the black house and the way that people disappear into the floor.
It was really arty, and, yeah.
But it managed to be both a really kind of kitchen sink realism when she's driving around,
yeah.
And then suddenly this strange science fiction landscape, and the kind of way those two things hit each other. It was really impressive. That, and she didn't,
it was like a juxtaposition, but it managed to sort of seamlessly connect.
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it?
And actually, I think she's... Because she's in the Avengers movies as the Black Widow. And actually, I think she's really...
Oh, I'm juggling about four different thoughts at the moment, Nigel. Can you stop talking about lots of interesting things? Because I'm thinking about how am I going to...
I'm all about the
episodic
digression.
Yeah, no, but I like, am as well. But we're both air signs. You're a Gemini, aren't you? And I'm an Aquarius, so...
But she had this... But she's pulled herself back.
Yeah.
In the not, I mean, I don't know whether she does wrong, but she's not doing things like, she's just not that into you, or kind of rubbish films like that.
Mm.
So, and it's not the rom coms are inherently bad, but it's a trap for young actresses that you don't that get leaks. Taken seriously.
Yeah.
And then you don't get the good roles. And Melancholia was like a real sign of, oh, of course she is great.
Mm.
And she's really good at Melancholia.
It was brilliant. And that what you've said there links in with about four different things that I was going to say. I think, Melancholia, I was initially drawn in by the visual.
Mm.
Then I watched it, and it was hard going, because, as we were talking about before, with your lovely housemate, about the fact that it was just really slow and really, like, drawn out and really... It took a long time to actually get to the point, but that made you become depressed with them. And that kind of spoke to me, because as an artist, I think anyone who is creative in any way, shape or form has dark periods of time that they have to cope with.
I mean, it's far more common just out in the world than anyone really wants to admit.
Yeah, and I think if you're an interesting person, you've got to be slightly nuts. In my book, you know, none of my friends are normal. I mean, what is normal anyway? But going back to the Under the Skin, that links into the next Lars von Trier film that I really liked as well, because she was sort of sexually predatory with these men.
Yeah.
Nymphomaniac, I love that. And I've only just discovered it, and I don't know when that was out. I saw it on Netflix. And
yeah, it's very recent. I've not seen it yet.
It was by Lars von Trier as well, and I looked him up, and he did this thing called a Depression Trilogy.
Yeah. Well, it's... I mean, Under the Skin, and if maybe very interesting, in the Under the Skin is kind of... It's strange, it's kind of erotic without being actually sexual.
Yeah.
I mean, when she takes these men back into her house, it's not like something like, you know, Species. It's just visual. Where, you know, where it's, you know, most of the time she doesn't even, you know, she's just kind of stripping off, she doesn't even need to get naked before the men have been consumed. There's a lot of films that would take that as an excuse to have a bit of,
yeah,
bit of T&A.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Nymphomaniac is deeply explicit about sex, but it's not really meant to be, you know, well, I guess it probably is meant to be a bit titillated because it's Lars von Trier, but at the same time, it's mainly the sex that to explore, you know, this character's journey as honestly
but
as possible.
But the sex that she's having is also meaningless and, like, numb. Like, she literally says, like, I can't feel anything. It's like she's banging her head against the wall. She's not even doing it to feel human or to feel excited or to feel, you know, like a one night stand throwaway, you know, bit of fun. She literally cannot feel anything. She had this episode, the main character, I can't remember her name, I'm terrible with things like this, as I say, but she had this episode when she was masturbating in a field or something, and then all of a sudden she lost all sensation sexually, and that's what's interesting. And I think that her character's quite... she tries to be hateful. She tries to make the man... What's his name, the character? She tries to make the man hate her.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's asexual,
right,
he can't relate to what she's talking about. And it's quite an interesting concept.
He's one of the few people that she can't use to try and feel something or not.
Yeah, she can't manipulate or she can't turn on or anything like that. So... It's like they're sort of, there's a disjunct between them because they don't have a similarity physically, but in every story she tells, he digresses and makes it related to something completely other, but yet there is a tedious link. And like he'll talk about fly fishing, but you can hear he has cleverly linked it in, and it's not like he's trying to change the subject because he's uncomfortable. It's like he's trying to relate it to his own experience because he isn't offended, he isn't disgusted by what she's saying, but he is asexual and he doesn't actually have any visceral, sexual, real, physical feelings about what she's talking about.
So, I mean, I've just not got around to seeing Nymphomaniac. It's one that when you see a film that's meant to be good but is deeply explicit, I always feel a bit weird about going to the cinema to see it.
I know, yeah.
I can't go on my own.
I always feel orcs.
I've got to go with a friend.
Yeah.
And then all my friend, like cinema going friends had already seen it. It's like, oh god. Yeah. And it's like, well, watch it at home. Okay,
Netflix,
fine. Yeah, except I don't want to be like halfway through one of the deeply explicit, actually quite pornographic scenes for my housemate to come in and just be like me watching pornography on the big telly downstairs. it's kind of
she's a cool lady though, she totally understands.
I'm sure it'll be fine, but it's just the awkward moment of
so, I know that always happens as well.
But I've had
that always happens.
But I've had it recommended to me. I've had it, even had it recommended to me by people that didn't like it. Because the thing with Lars von Trier is that, because not all of his films are necessarily good, and he's got this kind of cheeky imp, like doing. Sometimes he does do things to kind of get a reaction out of people, and to kind of he's got this kind of trickster attitude. But he's one of the most deeply original filmmakers. There's usually something, some memorable image or some thought-provoking idea there. I mean, my favourite film, I think, that I've seen him was Dogville, which was where...
Oh, I've never seen that before.
It was... and they did a follow-up in 2005 called Mandalay. But basically what they did was they built this set that was more like a theatre stage.
Right.
So so they've got this great big sound stage, and it's all black, and all the houses, so it's this village. So it's like Depression-era America, and this woman comes
into
this village.
Depression again, that's a theme.
Yeah. And she comes into this village, she's hiding from something, and the villagers initially take her in, and then ultimately kind of turn on her and abuse her. But all of the houses in this set, they're all just like outlines on the floor.
Oh.
So it's artificial in a way that films often aren't. But if you go to this, it's the kind of thing that, that the kind of thing, and initially it's a bit distancing, but then you get used to it. And it's interesting because you'll see these wide shots of a character, two characters acting, and in the background you'll see, you'll just see through the walls of the other houses and see people going about their business and doing things.
Mm.
I did a Follicle Mandalay, which wasn't as good. But Dogville's really good. Dogville's when Nicole Kidman was still making interesting films.
When you talk about the outlines, that reminds me of two things. So the first point is, the reason, another reason why I loved Nymphomania was because the front cover had parentheses, and as a literary genius yourself, you'll empathise with the love of pedantry surrounding these things. They're very important, and I'm here looking at your gilt-framed first piece of writing about robots, which is exceptionally cool. And how old were you when you wrote it?
I've got no idea. I think I was like six or something.
And excellent full stops and capital letters. So that was the first thing I wanted to
Well, don't look too closely, because you'll see that my shelves are mainly kind of Terry Pratchett books and comics. But it's kind of undermining my literary...
That's all right. That's still cool. You've got to have fun. You've got to have different... You've got to have diversity. You can't always be about the bard and about, I don't know, Chaucer or whatever. Or Ferdinand de Saussure, who just came into my head. Just felt a bit punsy.
So Dogville's not a really good picture, but you see they've made this sort of close.
Yeah.
And so all the kind of furniture's in there, but it's...
Mm, that's it's almost like a builder's
plan. It's like an
architectural...
Like a blueprint, yeah.
Yeah.
And people, it's really interesting film.
Like the deeds of the street.
And again, like... Even the follow-up doesn't work as well. But there... It's just that's come out of his head, a way of doing a film that no one's thought of before or done. Or at least, I mean, maybe it has got some precedent somewhere, but certainly I'd never seen that before.
Mm.
And that's kind of what you get. The idea of, you know, this completely, honestly, sexually explicit film. It's a weird thing with films, in that as much as I'm uncomfortable with the way that Hollywood, where, you know, women's bodies are a currency that you can just splash across a film to please an audience.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, I've got no problem with nudity.
No.
But and I think there is possibly the only way you can really honestly talk about sex, not all the time, but you reach a point where some things about sex you can only really talk about during a sex scene. But it's not many actors, understandably, willing to go through with, and even with like Nymphomania, they use digital effects trickery so that most of the actors that were having sex on screen weren't actually having sex on screen. They've just kind of you know, CGI'd it. But it's,
I suppose it's a sad yet I don't know how to put this, but at least the main character was a woman. Because we were talking, weren't we, before about all the superhero movies, because I know you're a bit of a fan.
I do love a bit of exploding buildings and such. Like, no, and you said that because they don't pass Bechdel test, and it took me a good few minutes to think of
something
ones. There is a couple that are, but not really in a satisfying way. Like in X-Men 3, it technically passes the Bechdel test because Storm has various fights with a female baddie.
But it's she like, fights with them, but she doesn't talk to them.
Well, no, but she talks to them, but it's like them trading, they're like trading witty, oh, I'm going to beat you up so bad kind of barbs. It's like, that's not really a conversation. As much as you are two women, you're not talking about a man, you're not really, you know. And Iron Man 3's got like an extended conversation between Pepper Potts and like a female scientist, which is just about the plot. Which is fine, but at the same time, it's just like there's still not many that have in any way dug into actual kind of female relationships. Whereas Hunger Games, which isn't like a superhero film, but kind of exists in a similar kind of fantasy thing, that's done astonishingly good business, because audiences were looking for that. Were looking for.
Oh my god! I've just seen your Ninja Turtle.
Ninja Turtle. That's a legitimate 1980s Ninja Turtle
I
rescued
was
from my parents' house.
And it's in a Star Wars. Yeah,
it's in.
Like
it's in the Millennium Falcon. He's just for
you
the people at home.
Easter eggs you haven't eaten.
Yes.
What kind of a person doesn't eat Easter eggs from Easter?
I don't eat a lot of chocolate.
I love chocolate. How could you even let that be there? Do you want to crack one open? No, because it might be off.
Easter's up for 5 years. What's this help?
Do they? Oh, all right then. Yeah, it's Donatello as well, isn't it?
Oh, it might be off.
See, you shouldn't be a hoarder. My friend from school is a Gemini and she's a hoarder. She doesn't get rid of stuff. Yeah, it's Donatello. The best colour.
Donatello is riding the cockpit on the Millennium Falcon. He was the scientist guy. He did have
good quips.
He was...
Oh no, was that Raphael who had good quips?
Raphael was the sarcastic kind of one. Michelangelo was the funny one. That was Turtles. I did a whole podcast.
Did you ever try those pizzas that they brought out as a result of their pizzas?
Marshmallow and sardines. Oh no, I've not done that. I'm sure I did some kind of Turtles branded one, but I definitely didn't have. There's a line. There's no way my parents would have let me eat something. As much as my parents weren't kind of middle class foodies, at the same time, there's no way they'd let me eat something that's so blatantly bad for you. It's like, there's no pretending.
Come on, marshmallows on pizza? What's wrong with that?
It's marshmallows and they're on a pizza. That's what's wrong with that.
I've never tried it, but it sounds pretty fit, actually, because if it was... Yeah, it'd be quite melty, wouldn't it?
Well, maybe I should do a whole podcast on pop culture tie-in foods. And then and do a taste test for everything.
Oh, I want to be there if you do that. that sounds really good.
Okay, well...
I'll help make some of the stuff.
I'm going to make a note about that.
Do you like the Tudors, by the way?
I never really got into it.
Did you not?
I watch bits of it.
I like the Tudors. I like Rome. I really like Game of Thrones.
Rome.
Even though I'm so, paradoxical, because actually they don't go with a lot of my personal beliefs. They sort of go against a lot of what I believe in, you know, what general society should be like. But yeah, I love Game of Thrones. I think they're awesome.
Do you mean in terms of the attitude of the people that make the show, or in terms of just the behaviour of the characters?
Just entertainment and I can just kick back, watch them and just be taken away. I quite enjoy that. I don't start thinking, oh, this is wrong. This is because it's fiction. So
yeah. Well, and also, we're not necessarily meant to be cheering for the characters in Game of Thrones and Tudor as well. That's kind of basically what happened. I mean, obviously, the dramatic license and all that, but it's.
Yeah. That's how I learned about history. I don't have to teach it, so it's all right.
We've got Wolf Hall coming up, which is Henry VIII.
Oh, I thought that, looked interesting.
I mean, I really like the books. The books are really good. And it's got Mark Rylance as Cromwell, and Rylance is, you know, one of the great actors. Okay, we've rambled a bit. I think let's start pulling it back around some kind of summing up. A bit of a rambling but entertaining conversation, pop culture pedos.
Yeah, Frozen and my gig.
Okay, we'll end with the gig. What pop culture are you looking forward to in the coming year? Or what would you like to see more of?
Interesting. I don't really know. I really enjoyed Frozen. I know it's really ridiculous and childish, but I think it's one of the first Disney films where actually a woman doesn't need a man to stay alive, which is quite a interesting feminist perspective. Well, there.
But also that...
Or to save her.
You know, what's interesting is that Hollywood has only just realised that making films with women with agency, having their lives and not necessarily in a romantic context, is a business decision. So that and Hunger Games, you know, it's like,
yeah,
and Divergent and all these ones, it's like, oh, people will go to those films. There's always the assumption that you know, it has to be low budget rom coms, and the only big budget films are for boys and they're for explosions because only boys will go and see them. But no, if you give us interesting characters, and excitement, we'll go and see it.
Anything, yeah.
And it's interesting because like Pixar's Brave, which isn't one of the best Pixars, although I like it, that has really had this great life because it's about a young woman's relationship with her mother, essentially, and that all the, you know, she's supposed to want a suitor, but she's got no time for that. She wants to ride a horse and do archery, yeah,
like Mulan.
Yeah, from years ago, yeah. So it's, I mean, I'm glad we are gonna get more of that, which is great. You know, there's another Hunger Games film coming up, which I think is gonna be great.
Yeah, I've been enjoying those.
Yeah, and they're just really good films. And for me, like, you know, an Orange Is the New Black has been really successful.
I've got that written down. Okay. I loved it.
I just loved it. And the thing is, it's almost the silver lining of the fact that women's stories have been so poorly presented in like high end media.
Mm.
Is that there's this wealth of stories I've not seen before, wealth of characters I've not seen before, that I'm waiting to discover. So Orange Is the New Black was so great because...
Amazing soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
The opening song by Regina Spektor.
Oh, yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
No, She's one of my idols. She's fantastic.
Oh, I was so lucky. I saw her twice in Manchester's Night and Day Cafe.
Brilliant.
So it's like a tiny 50. Yeah, yeah. The first time,
4 years ago,
it was like 2 years on the run. The first time it was quite full. The second time it was the first time there were tables and people were kind of sitting on tables. So second time it was not even standing room only. It was people wedged in.
Yeah.
And it was so. It was when it was just her and, you know, and the piano.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But Orange Is the New Black. It's like all those characters and they're all three dimensional. All the ones that seem two dimensional. They're just waiting for a chance to show you that they're three-dimensional. That's a really impressive thing, is that the longer it goes on, it just has more time, rather than just focusing on a core three family,
yeah.
three characters, it's just waiting for a chance to show you who that person was, who they are, and how that's informed them.
Yeah.
And that's really, really impressive. And sometimes it's just hilarious and unique. And I'm glad... What I'm really looking forward to catching up with, which I've not watched yet, is Transparent, which is on Amazon, which is about a family where the father comes out as trans and has transitioned to being a woman.
Oh.
And it's a family...
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's a family that's kind of...
Is it the character from Orange Is the New Black?
Like, no. I mean, it's got... There's a thing that...
Laverne Cox.
No, I think she's a bit busy with Orange Is the New Black. But it's got quite a few trans actors in it as like the supporting cast. The main actor isn't trans, but, and I've heard and maybe a really good justification for it, because it's the guy, it's Jeffrey Tambor, who's in Arrested Development. And,
I love Arrested Development.
And what it does by making...
You're a hot mess.
Yeah, but by making that character, this was argued on the Pop Culture Happy Hour, which is a really great podcast, by making a character that we know as male, kind of female... We kind of go through something similar that the family does, so it puts us in their position of having to make that adjustment. And it's a family that's got, you know, some of them are gay and they're happy with that, and they're middle class and they're tolerant, but they still struggle with this. And it's that idea of no matter how tolerant we think we are, there's always something that might rattle us.
The fight continues, definitely.
Yeah, and it's really great. And the writer is based on, because her father came out as trans, and she's even. She was like, oh, well, I should have a trans writer on staff, and there wasn't a trans writer writing at that level.
It's
so,
all about the equal ops policy.
But what she's doing...
Equal opportunities officer for Hackney.
But what she's doing, she's training someone up. She's got someone on as a writing assistant with a view to train her up to be a writer. And that's great. So she's not just gone, oh, well, he's not
she's
there.
She's actively
helping.
And
it's great, because if you're doing that kind of story, someone who's been through that experience should be in the room somewhere. So I'm looking forward. That's not new, but it's I think it's been out a few months. It's on Amazon.
That's really interesting. Actually, there's a new one more new thing coming out. It's my a really inspirational female I met through the union, who's retired now. Her daughter is Saffron Burrows. We're going to go and see Made in Dagenham next week, which should be really, really good fun. So looking forward to it, because obviously we've got a trade union background and we're activists. Anyway, her daughter is in this new thing on Amazon, and she had to actually learn how to play
Mozart
the cello.
In the Jungle.
That's the one. It looks great.
I saw a trail for it, because I was a bit like, what the fuck's that? But I saw a trail for it, and actually it looks really entertaining.
Intriguing, yeah.
It's got really well reviewed.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's probably long enough.
Mm-hmm.
So... If people want to hear your music,
mm-hmm.
where can they hear your music? Both in recorded and live
situations. Oh, thank you.
Situations.
Well, I'm Nix Nugent on SoundCloud. That's NIXNUGENT. and you could come to see me at Bohemia, which is in Hackney, underneath the arches, on Friday the 23rd of January. Is that correct? Is that the right date? Because I've just confirmed with with Viz my date.
Friday the 23rd.
Fantastic.
That is a real date, yes.
Yeah, that's a real date. So, yeah, pop down about 8:30, come and grab a drink and come and chat to me. Thanks for having me.
Really great. No, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed our chats. Hopefully we can have you on when we do the pop culture taste test.
Awesome. I'm making the marshmallow pizza.
great, Nick Student. Thank you very much.
Cheers.